brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you? Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark with Charles W. Chuck Bryant, one of the Fanta girls, it turns out.
What?
Don't you remember the Fanta girls?
Oh, don't you want that song?
Yeah.
Don't you wanna, something.
Mm-hmm. And they were almost like the Fruit of the Loom guys. As a matter of fact, they possibly were married.
Yeah. That'd be an interesting offspring.
That's what goes on in television in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm drinking a Fanta orange.
Which is why I brought it up.
Yeah, I have one of these a couple times a month. That's my indulgence.
That's your indulgence?
Well, that's my work indulgence.
I got you. Okay. That's good. You got to separate work life from home life, Chuckers.
Yes, you do.
Are you happy?
I am.
Okay. Are you ready to start?
Yeah, this is going to be a good one. And it's timely, which is always nice.
Yeah, because you know that the debates are going on right now. The presidential debates are going on right now.
Yeah, the primary debates?
The presidential debates.
Yeah, but they're not official, are they?
Well,
we'll get to that.
I guess, well, that was my whole thing.
Okay.
So, have you been watching them at all?
I've watched a few of the Republican debates. I find it very entertaining and fun to watch.
It is amazing how the horse race is just the best sports metaphor or analogy for these debates overall.
Yeah.
But not just like a horse race, like the kind like the tin horses like at the carnivals.
Uh-huh.
Like that. Because Herman Cain will edge forward with his 999 plan, and then NPR's like, have you really heard about this 999 plan? Let's get into it.
Yeah.
And Herman Cain just kind of hangs his head and goes back a little bit. Mitt Romney is, you know, positioning forward and backward and
sure.
All that. But the I was looking on Google News for something to open this up with. And I mean, that was about all I came up with. But everywhere you turn, everywhere you look, these are called presidential debates, when, in fact, they are not presidential debates.
True.
They're GOP primary debates. And they are certainly not official presidential debates, which can only be carried out by one group called the Commission for Presidential Debates.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to the bottom of in this.
That's right. Have you seen the Saturday Night Live skit on the GOP debates thus far?
No.
It's pretty good. Like, you know how I feel sorry for like some of these candidates that just are clearly shoved to the outside by the rules, and they're just like,
right,
have
you
no
mean
chance.
Ron Paul?
Yeah. Well, that was the joke. It showed, you know, Romney and Cain and Perry, and I think Bachman was in there in the main room, and then it showed like a side room where they went to two other candidates. I can't remember.
Santorum?
Maybe so. Yeah, Santorum. No.
Santorum, Huntsman, and
actually, it showed Santorum in a dance club. And then it showed Ron Paul. And then it showed Ron Paul through, like, a surveillance camera in the parking deck. And he was just standing there in the parking deck by himself.
That's awesome.
But it's very representative of how these things kind of go down sometimes. It's clear that some of these candidates just, like, you might as well not even show up.
Yeah, but good for Ron Paul because he does keep showing up no matter what.
Yeah.
And they joke about it often.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea that a candidate can not be treated fairly in these is just kind of mind-blowing to me. But that's not even the official debates where it's pretty much like written down that you can mistreat candidates that aren't Republican or Democrat, right?
Sure.
So, Chuck, you're a big debater. You're in debate club. Familiar with – you wear your blazer all the time.
We didn't even have that at my school.
I don't think we had it at my school either.
Yeah.
But are you familiar with the history of debates in America, presidential debates in America?
I am now.
Are you?
Yeah.
So what does it harken back to?
Well, if you want to go back to the beginning, that seems to be where you were leading me. It all sort of started out in 1858 when a young buck named Abe Lincoln was running for senator against Stephen Douglas, and he had a little habit of following Douglas around on the campaign trail, and during his speeches would sort of heckle him from the audience.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, we might as well debate since you're here.
Right. And he would also, so Douglas was just like, I'm not talking to you. What are you talking about? So Lincoln would also just follow him stop by stop in Douglas's wake and be like, "Well, you just heard from Douglas. Here's what I think about it."
Right, sort of a rebuttal.
So finally, Douglas agreed to it, which was pretty groundbreaking. And they had a series of, I think, like seven debates. It was about the existence of slavery. Douglas was pro divided country, slave states and free states. And Lincoln was like, this country can't survive like that. And Lincoln lost that election. And actually, when he ran for president in 1860, he didn't debate at all.
Yeah.
But that was the beginning of presidential debates. There was no moderator. There was no format other than these two guys standing there debating one another for 3 hours.
There was no TV.
Right.
There was no Anderson Cooper.
But that was the beginning of presidential debates in America.
That's right.
Out of a Senate race, no less.
Out of a Senate race. And then it was took a long hiatus, 15 election cycles, until 1948, when there was an actual presidential debate on the radio between Republican primary contenders Dewey and Stassen.
Yes.
And that got big ratings. I think you have between 40 and 80 million people listen to this, which was over a hot topic of the day, which was communism.
Outlawing communism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly not endorsing it.
No. It was like, how do you feel about communism, presidential candidate? You like it?
Yeah.
And then 4 years later, there's a pretty groundbreaking debate hosted by the League of Women Voters, who had become huge in debates later on. But this was their first foray, and it was a big one.
Yeah. I didn't realize how involved they were. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it is cool. The League of Women Voters in 1952 hosted a televised debate, the first televised debate ever, and it featured all of the candidates in both parties, in all parties, for president.
It's like a, what do they call that in pro wrestling?
The cage match?
Battle Royale.
Yeah.
Which isn't a cage, I think.
And probably or sometimes. Not always.
That's how I picture this debate, though.
Yeah, and a lot of talking and murmuring. It was probably a very loud debate, you know? But the League of Women Voters hosted this and then kind of went back out of the limelight again, and debates did as well, until the Great Debate, right?
Big B, Big G.
Big G.
Big D.
Debate.
How did I get that?
I don't know.
Yeah, you're talking about Kennedy Nixon in 1960. And this one was very famous because Nixon was in poor health. He had a staph infection.
Yeah.
He was not feeling well. Apparently, his gray suit blended into the background, making him look even more wan. And Kennedy rolled in there like all sunny California handsome.
Yeah.
I just, you know, met up with Marilyn Monroe look.
Right.
And people are like, hey, this guy looks great.
Yeah. And this is the first time the two party nominated candidates or nominees, were debated one another.
Just the two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a televised debate, 1960, and
CBS.
Yeah. And it basically established televised presidential debates as a force to be reckoned with in American politics, because a poll of radio listeners, they're just tens and tens of millions of people either listen to it on the radio or watch it on TV.
Yeah.
And a poll of radio listeners found that a majority thought Nixon won. A poll of television viewers found that Kennedy won, in their opinion.
That says it all.
Yeah, and it was largely because now there were aesthetics involved. It wasn't just, you know, talkies, you know, squawking out of a box.
Right.
Like, you could see what the person looked like. And if you looked terribly, like Nixon did, you were going to lose.
And this also led to what may be your best sentence in the history of your writing here.
What?
By the time the 21st century rolled around, they bore about the same resemblance to that first televised debate in 1960 as the game show in the movie The Running Man bears to You Bet Your Life.
Did you like that one?
I did.
Yeah.
I was delighted.
I'm glad. I read that and I was like, I'll bet Chuck likes that sentence.
That's fantastic. But you're right on the money with that.
Yeah. So 1960 changes everything, the Great Debate. From that point on, probably the thing that changed the most was the public came to expect debates. So now there was pressure on candidates.
Big time.
Yeah. But there's this thing that candidates could use to their advantage from the Communications Act of 1934 that established the FCC. And in that Communications Act was this thing called the Equal Time Provision. And the Equal Time Provision said, if you give media exposure to a bona fide presidential candidate, you have to give the same amount of exposure to that same to his rivals.
Yeah.
In the election, right?
Yeah, and that meant that you could, if you said, I'm not going to come to this debate, that pretty much canceled the debate.
Yeah, because you couldn't just let that person have the stage. It disqualified the equal time provision.
Yeah, and it's like it probably didn't look great to not debate, but it looked better than going on a debate and getting your butt handed to you on
right.
TV.
As Nixon did again and again and lost that 1960 election largely because of those debates with JFK, the televised versions of them at least.
Right.
And yeah, you get bad press for a news cycle or two in the newspaper
right.
that only, you know, hoarders keep.
Right.
But on television, that makes a really big impression. So yeah, Nixon himself used his presidential veto power to keep the FCC from repealing the equal time provision so that candidates couldn't do that any longer.
Right.
So he could keep dodging debates whenever he wanted to.
Exactly. That's why they call him Tricky Dick.
It is right.
One reason.
Yeah.
So that kind of, you know, in the 60s and 70s, debates were in bad shape until the LWV, League of Women Voters, stepped back in and said, you know what, we need to clean up this thing and we are women, hear us roar.
Right. And let's give a little background on them. They were born out of the suffrage movement.
That's right.
The League of Women Voters was because prior to the 19th Amendment and which was passed in 1920, you didn't have women voters. So right when the 20th Amendment or the 19th Amendment passed in 1920, all of a sudden you did. So the suffrage movement translated to the League of Women Voters and said, okay, now go forth and start shaping public policy through your votes.
That's right. So yay, League of Women Voters stepping in to take care of business and make sure these things go off in a fair way.
Yeah, because they were just getting hammered any way they could. But it wasn't just the League of Women Voters. It was the FCC had a ruling as well that allowed entree for the League of Women Voters to step in.
Was that when they declared it a debate, a bona fide news event?
Yeah.
And so they said, this is a news event. If you host a third party hosts it, then we have an exemption for the equal time provision all of a sudden.
Which means now
you have to debate.
The debate goes on without you.
Well, yeah, you don't have to debate, but you look really bad if you're not showing up.
Right, like Carter did. Carter refused to debate Reagan.
And Anderson.
And John Anderson, I think his name was. Who is an independent candidate.
Yeah.
And so Reagan was like, I'll do it. And Anderson was like, I'll do it. And they debated without Carter.
That perhaps lost the election for him.
That among...
Or was a contributing factor.
Many other things.
Was a contributing factor.
Yeah. I would say the oil embargo, the loss of Delta Force, seeking out the Iran hostages. There are a lot of things going against Carter.
He's done his best work since then, I think.
Oh yeah, he's a statesman.
So the LVW they took the reins from 76 to 84 or 88
because they stepped in as that neutral party that
right.
was needed to fulfill that FCC ruling.
So they said we need a good format. We need to split these formats into categories based on the types of or not the types, but how the questions are asked. And they used an open format which allowed follow-up questions among the candidates, which was really a big deal because you can't use your rehearsed. I mean, you can do it as much as you can, but
sure.
you can also get caught off guard and get that great spontaneity that you're looking for out of your president.
Yeah. And
or lack of.
Right. So, well, that was the thing. That's the big problem is, like, you've got your guy who now has to debate and who is debating on television who can just blow it all.
Yeah.
After a debate or two, you can just completely blow everything. Or, like, Herman Cain came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Just a businessman from Georgia, millionaire.
999.
Right. He came up with this plan and did really well in a couple of debates, and it just shot to the front. He passed Romney, I think, in polls for a little bit. So debates can really send you to the front of the pack,
sure.
or can just basically kill all of your chances. Political strategists don't like that at all. Campaign managers don't like that. They like to control everything.
Yeah, sure. Well, this was the heyday, though, then.
Right.
when the League of Women Voters were running the show, it was the heyday of presidential debates, for sure.
If you were a voter.
Yeah.
If you were a candidate, it was like hell on earth.
It was terrifying.
Yeah.
So, but that's how it should be.
Right.
Not hell on earth, but at least, like, you know, spontaneous and real and not rehearsed.
Right. So the League of Women Voters, they did not acquiesce to any demands of any candidates. They made very sure that all candidates who were qualified got equal time.
Yeah.
It was a really fair debate, and the Republicans and the Democrats did not like this.
They gave Ferraro a little more time, didn't they?
They
gave Geraldine Ferraro just a bit more time, didn't they?
Yeah. No? what was that, 84? Maybe so.
Yeah, she was Mondale's.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So the League of Women Voters kind of, I guess, made enemies out of the Democrats and Republicans who were like, wait a minute. This is, in effect, a two-party system, so we're pretty powerful. So let's get together. And they started in 1984, they said, you know what, we're going to veto 100 of the panelists you propose, and we're both going to do it.
They basically shut it down.
Yeah, they took control from the League of Women Voters, and the death knell came in the 1988 campaign between George H.W. Bush's campaign and Michael Dukakis's campaign, which got together and created what's called a memorandum of understanding.
Yeah, and they basically, I love that it took political candidates to not want to look like dummies to finally bring the two parties together on one thing.
Yeah.
They were like, well, we can agree on this, right?
Yeah.
And they did. And the memorandum of understanding was a little secret document that said who could be in the audience in the 88 debates, who could be a panelist, no more follow-up questions. And these are the terms. And the League of Women Voters said, that stinks, because now we're just hosting this event.
Is it?
So, screw you.
Well, they said that they resigned as basically the hosts of presidential debates.
Yeah, I love that they cited fraud on the American voter. That's pretty harsh.
Yeah. And so the Democrats and the Republicans were like, well, okay.
Perfect.
That's not bad. We got rid of the League of Women Voters, but we still need a neutral party. Who is a neutral party? Oh, I've got an idea. We'll create one from scratch. We'll create a neutral party together.
That we can control.
Exactly.
Even though they're neutral.
Called the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is a joint, nonprofit, bipartisan organization. And that is a very, very, very important word. Not nonpartisan, like the League of Women Voters.
Sure.
Bipartisan.
Yeah, that means we represent two things.
Right.
Republicans and Democrats.
That's exactly right. So the CPD, the Commission on Presidential Debate, was established in 1988, took over hosting presidential debates. It became the only organization that could legitimately host
an official
presidential debate. Scheduled four of them. For a presidential election, one of which is always a vice presidential debate.
Those are always fun.
Yeah. And basically, it does a lot for the Democrats and the Republicans, Chuck.
Yeah, they have to, obviously, it starts about a year out because it takes a lot of time to plan. They have to pick the location, have to pick the moderators. The locations are, it's a little tricky because you want a neutral site, and when you have, you know, a panel of candidates up there, they're from all over the country. They, you know, a lot of times they're at colleges, and so it obviously can't be tied to that candidate in any way.
Right, it can't be their alma mater.
Yeah, so it takes a while to get everything lined up and probably in the back rooms secretly approved by everybody.
Exactly, because it's like, well, I want this podium to be this high because I can't look short on camera. And I like, my candidate likes the debate hall temperature at this.
Yeah, and what's the background look like?
Because exactly.
We don't want you fading away like Richard Nixon.
Right, but the CPD, or the CPD provides like a even bigger function for Democrats and Republicans that acts as a shield. So it can issue some really unpopular decisions.
Yeah.
But it's not beholden to the public at all.
Sure.
It answers only to the Democrats and Republicans. And it since it acts as a shield, everybody gets mad at the Commission on Presidential Debates when really it was the two campaigns that came up with that decision.
Yeah.
Like Perot.
That happened with Perot in 92. Everyone remembers Ross Perot. And that was pretty bad Perot, actually. And he was from the Reform Party. had just a 7% rating before the debates. On election day, got about 19% of the vote, which is a huge jump, the biggest ever.
Yeah.
So in 1996, when he reared his little head again, Dole and Clinton both said, we don't want to debate this guy. We don't want him around. And so essentially the FCC changed the provision. The CPD said, you're not coming.
Right, because of that equal time provision had been, like, canceled.
Right, and that was the shield. So even though Clinton and Dole were behind it, it was really the CPD who put, like, the press release out there, so they took the hit for it.
Right, and some poll found that, like, 6% of voters blamed the Clinton campaign for it, 19% blamed the Dole campaign, but 50% blamed the Commission on Presidential Debates. So, shield activated.
Yes.
And... they also got rid of any kind of spontaneity, where if you watch presidential debates now, they're basically like, they're just press releases.
Yeah, campaign speeches.
There's no follow-up questions. There's just like, here's the question that you've known for 3 weeks we're going to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear your answer.
Yeah.
So it's just completely managed and massaged. So,
Were criticized too.
Yeah. John Kerry had a good criticism in 2000. He said, quote, you could have picked 10 people off the street who didn't know Jerusalem from Georgia and they would have had better questions. So that's where we stand right now. The Commission on Presidential Debates, it still runs the show as much as ever.
They play it a little looser though. Like, these candidates sort of run over the rules, like barring someone like Anderson Cooper coming out there and taping someone's mouth shut. You still see them, like, you know, running over the time. And I remember when Bush and Gore debated one another, there's just so much sniping about, well, I was supposed to have my time and he had his time, so I'm going to take extra time. And it sort of gets out of hand a little bit.
Was it a presidential debate or a primary debate?
No, I mean, if it was Bush and Gore, it wasn't a primary debate,
but was it, like, hosted by CNN or something like that, or was it official?
I don't remember. I mean, it was the famous one where they started showing reaction shots, and it showed George Bush getting all perturbed each time Gore would, you know, they had the split screen up, basically.
Right. So that one was 2004 between Kerry and Bush.
Well, they did the same thing with Gore, because I watched it earlier.
And George Bush was annoyed?
Well, they just showed a split screen. So while Gore was talking, it showed Bush's reactions the whole time, and then vice versa.
Right, and apparently there was a memorandum of understanding that the networks were just like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to film breakaway shots.
That may have been a CNN thing, though. You're right.
Yeah.
It may not have been official.
So let's see. What else, Chuck?
Well, what makes an ideal debate? We've poo-pooed it. What makes a good one?
Well, a good one, like you said, it needs to be fair. So, like, the CPD is doing some stuff fairly, like not holding a debate at the alma mater of one of the candidates or their home state or their hometown or anything like that.
Yeah, and they can't. You also pointed out that it's usually a bigger city too, because you have to have 3,000 available hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And pay a $7,500 application fee, so that rules out anywhere in Kansas.
Right. Pretty much.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also the division of time is very important.
Sure.
You know, most of the time, candidates will they'll almost always get time at the beginning.
Sure.
And at the end.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, that's where it kind of gets, like, wild and crazy. Like, how are you going to divide the time? And, you know, is there going to be rebuttals? Are you going to allow cross-examination? That's very rare. But ideally, everybody has equal time in the middle, and then you usually have, like, a moderator.
Yeah, there's three formats, basically.
Well, there's moderator, panel, and town hall.
Yeah.
And there's almost always a moderator, no matter what, in all three of them.
Yeah, and the panelists, it's, like you said, there still could be a moderator, but you just have more than one person replacing... So there's a moderator, replacing the moderator with a panel, but you still have a moderator.
Right.
Sort of confusing.
It is. And then town hall is usually the...
are fun.
The audience asking questions.
Yeah.
Cross-examining the candidate. That's a very rare one, too, because, you know, anything can happen. Somebody could go off script.
Yeah. That's true.
You
have to actually qualify for debate. You can't just say, hi, I'm Joe Walsh, and I'm running for president, and I want to be on there. singing Rocky Mountain Way.
Yeah, the rules for qualifying for a debate are that you have to be it has to be statistically possible for you to win in the Electoral College. So your name has to appear on like a certain amount of state ballots, right?
Yeah, and you have to have a 15% voter support before the debate.
Right. But if you qualify for that, and a lot of people do, then you can be in these debates, supposedly. That was League of Women Voters stuff.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
So some of that still carried over?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. So these things are important, though, nonetheless, because, you know, nowadays you're influenced almost as much by what everyone says about the debate as the debate itself. Because immediately after, and actually even during sometimes, the debates, the networks and the cable stations and the internet will start saying, well, who won? This was strong. He was strong here.
All right.
She was strong there. They poll people on, you know, immediately afterward, either on the internet or by telephone,
yeah,
and sort of say, well, this is who won, regardless of what you think.
Well, yeah. And then once the poll's released, it's like, yeah, your perception is affected.
It's all about perception.
If you were maybe on the fence before, it's like, oh, well, everybody else thinks they won, and then heck yeah, they won, of course. There are some classic examples of clear winners and losers in debates. Like you mentioned,
yeah,
George Bush like looking annoyed during breakaway shots.
But he won.
He still won.
Mm-hmm.
I think his father was caught looking at his watch a bunch of times during the 1992 debate,
yeah,
with Clinton.
That was pretty big.
Dan Quayle in the vice presidential debate, he compared himself. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah, man. Big, big mistake.
He compared himself to, this is Dan Quayle.
Yeah.
He compared himself to John F. Kennedy.
Well, it was a loose comparison, though, wasn't it? I don't remember the exact quote, but
I think he was probably talking about his youth and vigor.
Yeah, but I think I remember at the time feeling like he got shut down by
Lloyd Benson.
Lloyd Benson. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine, and you, Senator, are no Jack Kennedy. I remember feeling at the time like he wasn't really saying he was like Jack Kennedy.
Yeah.
I felt sort of bad for him, but
Benson pounced on him.
He pounced on him just like Reagan did, and I watched that clip earlier too. He got a good laugh in the Mondale debate.
Yeah.
When I can't remember the moderator, but he asked Reagan about his health and his age as the oldest candidate, and they said, you appeared tired recently after your meetings in Russia, and quite honestly, do you have what it takes health-wise to be president? And or to remain president, I think it was re-election, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, because he'd be Carter. And he said, "I'm not gonna, you know, bring age into this equation. I don't want to exploit for political purposes the youth and inexperience of my candidate or my rival."
Yeah.
And Mondale even busted out laughing. It was a very nice, light moment.
Mondale was awesome. He loved a good joke,
even when he was the butt of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was that kind of guy.
Or at least he was in that case.
He was the 80s George McGovern. So, Chuck, we talked about the 1960, the Great Debate, changing everything. Television changed everything.
Sure.
And then the two political parties wrestled that change and used it to their advantage. But now social media is starting to have that impact, and it really kind of popped up most for the first time in 2008. There was, like, the CNN YouTube town halls.
Yeah.
Which were pretty cool, but...
Yeah.
You know, people were allowed to submit questions on YouTube, and then the two campaigns got to choose what questions were answered or chosen.
Yeah, which they were criticized for.
Yeah, but MySpace and MTV held town halls, and
what's MySpace?
It's some social media site. I think it's like Get Glue or something.
Oh,
like
that's
that.
Oh, that's cute.
But it's like it has cobwebs on it.
Yeah,
it's weird. I guess it's for Halloween though.
Gotcha.
But the MySpace MTV town hall, I think they were town hall formats. The moderator chose questions as they came in live. So that was like a triumph.
Yeah. Tech geeks loved it.
Yeah. But I mean, think about it. That's re-injecting spontaneity through
sure.
social media.
Yeah. True. I'm sure Facebook was involved in this last, or not involved, but certainly lit up.
Well, they picked 2-1.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mark Zuckerberg and Eric Schmidt decided who it was.
And Twitter played a part too, right?
Yeah. There was that debate between McCain and Barack Obama, or their surrogates who knew how to use Twitter. and they were responding to questions from a moderator from Time in 140 characters or less.
I'm sure McCain had no idea what Twitter was at the time. You know,
do you remember there was this one debate between, it was an official debate between Obama and McCain, and McCain looked like he was just wandering around this set,
mm-hmm.
like he didn't know where he was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then Obama seemed like a schoolboy, like when the moderator was like, "Your time's up," he'd stop real quick and look at him like, "Am I in trouble?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "These are the two guys, huh?"
Well, and that just proves though how like influence of perception in television, even from a silly like going to commercial break shot of like McCain wandering around or something, and Obama.
While Obama was answering, he was just wandering around.
Oh, well, you know.
It was something, but yeah. It's
all about
hugely
perception.
Influenced my perception.
Yeah, big time.
But it influenced my perception of Obama, too, that, like, he wasn't...
quite ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something else. That television, huh?
Yeah.
Let's go vote, Chuck. Let's go vote for something.
Yeah, I'll vote.
Don't you feel like voting on something?
Suffrage.
That's already been done.
Oh, okay.
If you want to read a... really literary article on presidential debates written by me. Chuck's not a big fan of it. I don't blame him. It's cool.
I thought it was good.
You can type in presidential debates in the search bar at howstuffworks.com. Yeah?
Yes.
Which brings up listener mail.
Josh, occasionally we like to shout out to our troops overseas. We're doing that right now.
Okay.
Hi, guys. Norm, who is... Lizelle's husband, Lizelle wrote in. Norm is currently stationed, because we had conversed back and forth, that's why it seems very casual here. Norm is currently stationed at FOB Salerno in Afghanistan.
What is that, front operating base? Forward operating base.
Sounds right. In the 352nd Combat Support Hospital in the Khost Province. That is K-H-O-S-T, Khost Province. He is a trauma nurse working the evening shifts and will be there till the end of February 2012. Many in his unit are working 12-hour shifts, 5 to 6 days a week, providing medical care to both U.S. troops and Afghan civilians. Right now, his family basically is the unit in Afghanistan. So I was wondering if you can give a shout-out to him and his CSH, or even do a show about how medical combat support hospitals work. That would really help make him and others in his unit happy. A lot of them are kind of blue right now, obviously, for being in the same place, doing the same thing day in and day out while handling the trauma there. Norm secretly wishes that you and Josh would be a part of the USO and travel and share your show with folks abroad.
I would go to Afghanistan.
I would totally do that. I've listed a site which will give you more information on the people who have given a year or more to help our country. So if you guys want to go check out what combat support hospitals are like, you can go to Operation Support Salerno.org, and that is SALERNO.org / soldier_support. So nice. Operation Support Salerno.org / soldier_support. Many thanks in advance, and that is from Lizelle F.
Nice, Lizelle.
My brother-in-law's going back for a year.
No way.
Yeah.
Where's he going?
He's going to Afghanistan.
Oh, really?
In January.
Wow. What does he do there?
He is a Marine colonel helicopter pilot. And, dude, he is in line to become a general.
No way!
Like, how cool is that?
That's really cool.
So we're all rooting for him for that.
And yeah, I'll bet. We should start some sort of social media effort on his behalf.
I don't think they care to consider that.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
It's quite a force to be reckoned with.
He'll make it. He's always been in the head of the class. He's one of those guys.
So also, if you want to know what a forward operating base hospital is like, you can just watch MASH.
Sure.
I'm sure that's a pretty accurate depiction.
Yeah, they just sit around and drink homemade whiskey or homemade gin. And right. Yeah.
Thank you, Lizelle. We appreciate that. And good luck to you and Norm. And good luck to your brother-in-law, Chuck.
Stay safe, everybody.
Yeah. If you want to let us know how your family's doing or interested, we want to hear. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Facebook. It's a big party over there. That's facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. And you can send an email in support of Chuck's brother-in-law to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?